Hey everyone, welcome to the Naughty Shaman Podcast. I'm your host, Natalie Carlisle, and I can't wait to dive in to a world where the sacred meets the wild and keeps things totally real. In each episode, we are going to dive into what it truly means to live a radiant life that is unapologetically real. And if you're ready to get started, so am I. Hey, hey, how are you? It is Natalie Carlisle on the Naughty Shaman Podcast. Thanks for tuning into this episode. I've been asked to share with you in this episode how I became a shaman, my stories, how it began, my stories with Alberto and working with the Four Winds, working in Chile. And so I thought I would start a series. And so in this episode, we are going to talk about my early journey of how I became a shaman. And this is part one. And I invite you to go on this journey with me back to my childhood, where it all began with the dream of the grandmother, with a death, with a loss, and with a learning. So thank you for coming on this ride with me of the story of how it all began. So I love to tell stories, and anyone who's been to Dharma school knows that I love stories that start with once upon a time, like all the legendary stories start there. And this one starts like any other legend, you know, this, our histories are our personal legends. And so once upon a time, when I was born after my mom had 9 miscarriages. So my mother had my brother and then 9 miscarriages and then me. Can you imagine the grief that was lingering in that womb and the heartache and the hope and the loss and the hope and the loss and the whole cycle? And so when I was born, I wasn't thriving and neither was my mom. We both, it was a big medical event. You know, I got whisked to the NICU. My mom got whisked to the ICU and we didn't connect for, you know, sometimes my mom would say it for 3 weeks. Sometimes my mom would say it for 3 days. Sometimes she would say for 2 months. And so the period of time in which we were apart, I'm not sure, but it was long enough that there developed this ache inside of us, me and her. And one night this nurse snuck me in to her room and we healed each other and, you know, lived happily ever after. So the story goes, I'm just kidding. So the beginning of my life was one of immediate challenge. And I would look at this first part of my life as kind of the crucible. And so when I was young, I would often have dreams of getting taken out of my home, and they were really real. I could feel the raindrops on my face. It was always raining, and like a gorilla or a jaguar or something from my storybooks would come into my home, snatch me out of my bed, and then carry me down through this cornfield during a rainy, stormy night. And that cornfield was literally right behind our house. I could feel the rain. I could see the yard. I could see my bed. And the dreams were so real. And I would just wake up screaming. So these dreams were when I lived in Maryland. So they were when I was 3, 4, 5 years old, I would have these dreams. I also began having dreams at that age of what I can only call Armageddon now. At the time, I would call them fire. Everyone died. There was war. Like I would have all of these super vivid, painful dreams of the end of life, like the end of life as we knew it. And they were terrifying dreams. And I'll never forget one of my really early dreams was of my dad and I, and we were standing at the top of this mountain and it was storming and raining again. And we were kind of back to back with these swords, and I was this little warrior and he was this big warrior, and it was like the oceans were rising up to engulf us and take us down. And that was like one of these horrendous dreams from when I was 5. Now, my poor parents, I remember waking up screaming. Like half the time I would go to sleep, I would just wake up crying. And you know, they were on and off for a while. But when we moved to Ohio when I was 6 years old, I remember my parents were so tired of waking up listening to me that when I was 6 years old, I was going into the first grade and my mom said, Natalie, If you stop dreaming about these dreams, then I will give you $5. And please don't talk about them at school because people will think you're crazy. And so I remember in my little Holly Hobby nightgown, because that was all the rage, I thought to myself, cool, I'll just stop talking about these things and I'll get $5. That's awesome. So then I went to school and of course I'm like, oh man, yeah, you know when like you dream of something and it's really weird and you wake up screaming? And all my friends were like, no. So there was this period of time where I just learned how awkward I was and how not everyone has this kind of vivid of a nightlife, so to speak. And so over time, I slowly learned that I was not normal. And my mom liked to point that out too, because she was really worried that I would talk about these weird things with people and then they would bully me. She was really looking out for me in her way. But at the time, what I was learning so young was to just hide, keep myself a secret that I'm not good. Like I need to be better. I need to be normal or else I won't have love. And so that learning of you have to be normal in order to get love was a truly painful learning of my youth. And because of that, I hid. So I hid all these magical things and I tried to watch other people and TV shows to kind of figure out how to act normal, if that makes sense. So, you know, I watch TV religiously, like a scientist, like, okay, that's a funny, this is when you, and just tried to be normal and not explain all this extra sensory stuff that was going on for me when I was young, hearing voices and literally what I always thought was God. Like me and God were always cool. I don't know why. We just connected and praying, talking out loud and hearing wind and trees and understanding bits and pieces of what that meant and feeling the emotionality of tall grasses. And that was just extra, if you know what I mean, for a young kid growing up in Ohio. And so I hid a lot. But the result of this hiding was that I did not feel comfortable in my own skin. Like I wanted to be someone else. I felt like it, like feeling weird, like weird doesn't even touch how I felt. I felt like almost like an alien. I felt like an outsider, like an outcast, and like I needed to cover and put on like the outfit. And I hated being in my skin. And as a result, this little bit of anxiety and depression started to get into my bones because I was not safe being who I was or expressing myself. And I started to scratch my skin. And I developed this terrible, terrible disorder. It's very akin to the hair pulling, but it's like this, if my skin isn't perfect, like I used to need to just peel it off in layers, because it was almost as if I wanted out of my skin. And it caused a lot of problems in my family and for me and my social life because, you know, my mom was constantly yelling at me to stop doing it. And of course, I couldn't. I didn't have any control over it. It was like an obsessive kind of compulsive thing that was just like self-soothing, like, it's okay, it's okay. You can get out of your skin, you can get out of your skin. So we spent a lot of time putting makeup all over it and putting long sleeve shirts on me and covering it up and not going out with friends because they might see how gross it was. And my mom wanted to cover me up and make sure I didn't go out when it was bad, when I was bad, when my skin was bad. And so there was this horrible feeling during all of my youth through high school of wanting to hide truly because I was some kind of grotesque alien. And to make up for that, I developed sort of an avatar who had like all of her shit together. And boy, did I prove it. I was like the president of everything. I was a good student. I was student council president, student body president, booster president, cheerleading captain, band. I was in the band. I played in the percussion section. Like anything I could do to prove to outsiders or to my parents or to some unknown force of they, to prove that I was worthy. And I hustled and jived and tried to prove that. but I still felt like this terrible wall between me and everyone else. And one day I remember I had a couple of close friends, thank goodness for the Paytons who lived up the street, because they were a godsend to me. And I don't know if I ever told them that. Hopefully they listened to this podcast. But my friend Kelly Payton at the time was like, you should try out for cheerleading. I'm like, okay. So we became friends and it was great. One of the best friendships. And we went to this party at this person's house. And I'll never forget that night because I walked in, I was nervous because of all these things, you know, by now are going on inside my head. And I'll never forget this long-haired, gorgeous man opened the door and said, hey, welcome. And then this other long-haired, gorgeous man came and this guy named Tim picked up my friend Kelly. This guy named Corey picked up me, threw us over his shoulders, and we ended up in the pool. And all I remember is I opened my eyes underwater and this gorgeous man's long hair is like floating in the pool. It was this angel sang. I was like, oh, there was this like magical connection, right? In my mind, you know, I was what, 16 years old or something. And man, I'll never forget that night. This was the night that I met Corey Firm Wingard. And this moment and all of the others really set me on the trajectory of becoming a walker between the worlds, a shaman. And so all we did that night was talk. I had a couple beers. We went home. Kelly and I talked forever. I really liked this person. And later that night, I had this dream, my first dream of grandmother, this grandmotherly figure. But I laid down in bed and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, it's impossible that I met this person that I think is so awesome. And, you know, I was starstruck literally and going to bed feeling really heavy. And that night, this grandmother came and she had this long silver gray hair and dark, dark, leathery, wrinkled skin, like a prune face, and blue, beautiful eyes, like clear like the sky. And this blue garment on that was like a poncho kind of thing that you'd put over like a white shirt or something. And it had designs down the front. And this grandmother just came to me and she held me in this dream. And I just remember feeling like maybe for the first time, kind of safe. And she sang the song and I'll never forget it. It was just the soul song. And she sang the song in this dream to me. And I rested. And it was my first strong contact, positive contact with the spirit world. And I was so grateful. I felt like all my anxiety and hating and scratching, all that RPM just dropped down a level. It didn't go away, but it dropped down a level to where I felt like I could breathe again. So over time, something about that night opened my heart and I learned to trust a little more. And I became better friends with Kelly and not so weird and socially awkward. And I became better friends with Corey from Wingard. And we would talk about things like past lives and dreams. And he didn't think it was weird. Neither did Kelly. And so I started to feel like, all right, maybe I'm not that much of a weirdo. And it was just a beautiful time in my life where it was like this spring of hope, 16 years old. And I was like, there's this hope of love, this hope of a great friend. And I was so feeling good for the first time, probably my whole life. And I'll never forget on a Friday morning, around 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, I got called down to the principal's office at high school and I had my cheerleading uniform on because it was going to be a pep rally. And then we had the Friday night football games and that's a big deal in Ohio, Friday night football. And I was the student council president or vice president at that time. So it was not a big deal for me to get called down to the office. I was there all the time. We were all like best friends because I was a dorky kid. I was like a leadership dork. And so I walk in there and I'm like, hey, what's going on, Mr. Kane? And my friend Kelly was there in her cheerleading uniform. And I'm like, oh my God. And she was crying. I'm like, Kelly, are you okay? What's going on? And she looked at me and said, Corey died. I was like, what? Like, we just saw them the other night. Like, there's no way. And she said, Corey and Tim were in this car accident and Corey died. And I just sort of split because my relationship with Corey was a secret for most people, certainly from my parents, because he was a bit older. And, you know, I was forbidden to see him. So, of course, I did. And we were friends, but there was this hope of more in me, you know? And we cried, Kelly and I cried and cried and cried. And then I remember I was just in a daze for the next several weeks, maybe even a month. And I remember going to the calling hours. And I had heard so many stories about Corey's family, and they were part Sioux Indian is how Corey would describe it. So part Lakota, and that was his father's lineage, and he was in the Air Force, and there were just all these beautiful stories and regrets he had of things he never told his dad. And so we had these shared, deep, intense, intimate stories. And so I met his father for the first time at the wake. And I remember looking into his blue eyes, just like Corey. And I remember saying, like, Corey talked about you a lot and he loved you. And Corey's father held my hand and he said, you must be Natalie. Corey talked about you to us all the time. And he had great hopes for your relationship. And he wanted to marry you when you graduated. And he kissed me on the cheek, and Corey had never kissed me. And so his father gave me this kiss, which, like, my brain was freaking out. My brain was like, oh my God, this is like a kiss that Corey never gave. And I told the dad the things that never, and he was going to give you this ring. And I'm like, oh my God, and sit with us at the funeral. So I remember sitting with the family that was not going to be my family of my dead husband's grave and putting dirt on it. And I remember thinking, well, there goes my love. And he died before I could ever even love him. And it messed me up, friends. I'm not going to lie. It was a crazy town in here for a little while. And I remember really learning in this moment, like, love's dead. Like, that was love. And I never had a shot at it, but it's gone. So there you go. It was the most bizarre time in my life, and I dreamt of Corey for 2 weeks straight. After that, my parents took Kelly and I to the Caribbean because they were super worried about me, because I came home from this funeral experience that was like brain boggling, and I sat in front of the mirror at the end of the hallway like this for like 2 or 3 days, and I was just looking into my own eyes like, I know he's in there. Where's Corey? I know he's in there. I know we're connected beyond life. And I never found him there. But I did find him in dreams down in the Caribbean near St. Thomas and St. John. My parents rented a sailboat because they could, and they wanted me to heal. And the water has been healing for my family since forever. And so on this boat, I remember I just slept the whole time I was there, and I dreamt of Corey. Every night we would live like a whole life. We live a whole life, Corey and I. We had kids and he'd play music. And then another night there'd be this dream of just him singing in the band. He was a singer in a band and the band was all there and we'd be having a great time. And then another dream when we were old and they were reading books and these chairs. And then the last dream that I had of Corey Firm Wingard was in the Caribbean. I remember dreaming I was sitting on a second top bunk of a bunk bed. And we were singing and laughing, and he goes, he sat up, and I remember thinking, well, that's weird. He's not hitting his head on the ceiling. He's wicked tall, so that's super weird, right? But the ceiling was kind of gone. It was like fading away. And then he's like, I gotta go. And I'm like, no, stay here. The band will wait for you. And he was like, no, I have to go, Natalie. And he stood up, and the ceiling vanished, and all this white light came. And I remember he was glowing and like happy. And he reached down his hand and he said, I want you to come with me. And I remember like reaching up and I touched his hand. And I swear to you now, I could feel, and even now telling the story, I can feel the other side. And I could feel it calling. And at the same time, I heard this other grandmother say, no, not yet. And I let go and I woke up And I never dreamt of him again. And it was like complete. And that night, another night, or I don't know what night, all the nights are so together. But the final dream I had of the grandmother that I want to share with you is that grandma came to me again. Same grandmother with the long silver hair and this blue cloak. She was amazing. I remember I was in such pain in my body and I was crying and crying and crying and in the dream and maybe in reality. And she said, Natalie, you've got to get rid of these things. And she just cut me open with her hand, like from bow to stern, and opened up my body and started pulling out these prickly balls of crap. They were like pine needle balls, but they were covered in goo. And she said, name it. And like this grandmother's yelling at me. And I was like, loneliness. And she threw it into the sun and it burst into flames. And then she pulled out another one and she said, name it. So this other gross pine needle spiky ball covered in black tar. She said, name it. And I was like, sadness. I'm so sad. And she threw it into the sun and it caught on fire. And then she said, name it. There were seven more of these horrible big clusters of sharp, bloody black things. Grief, shame, guilt, and then loneliness again. When I woke up from this dream, I started to feel better, like my feet were on the ground for the first time. So this is the story of how it began for me, because through the pain, and you know, I know people that have been married and lost their spouses. I cannot imagine that, having had the love and known the intimacy in real life, how that grief is. But there is a special kind of grief of the not yet had, the loss and grief of the hope of love. Is what I lost then in that moment. And it was so painful because I was seen and loved and not judged. And then part of that was gone. You know, I had my friends, thank goodness for the Paytons, but that loss of Corey was so hard, so difficult for me. And I call this period of my life the crucible, because one of the things that I wanted to share with you was that after Corey died, he was in the car with his best friend, Tim, and Tim lived and he almost didn't. Tim was a best friend of Corey's. We were all friends. Tim was about a half an inch away on the jugular from not living. And after this horrible thing happened, Tim lived down the street. We became friends and got really close and fell in love. And you know, the sharing of the grief, the burden of that particular grief of hope of our lives. He had hope. I had hope. We all had this hope and love of this man who died so young at 21. And together with Tim, I don't think I would have survived without him and his family for the kindness and for the support. And so that was an incredible lesson as well, is how much support can make a difference in your life. And so this time of life, the crucible, as I would call it, if you're in one, if you've had one, this I've learned is a natural part of a shaman's journey. The secrets, the hiding, the pain, all of it is not an accident. It is not that you are forsaken, which is what I believed for so many years. It is that you are on a path. And this crucible is forging you in fire. It is forging some lessons, because when you go through this kind of soul pain or physical pain, whatever the pain is that you're experiencing, there are two choices that it comes down to. You either find something inside of you to live for, to stand on. You find something inside of you that is solid, that is the one thing you know. And with all the stress, it is like under pressure, like coal to make a diamond, like forged in fire of a volcano in the center of the earth. This knowing inside of you becomes so strong And what I learned during this crucible that was forged in flames was that I'm connected to the other side. I'm connected to spirit. And that spirit is the only thing that you can count on, because it's the only thing that can never leave you. It can never die or go on a trip or decide it doesn't love you anymore. It's the only thing in the world that is eternal. And so from this ripe young age, I developed a need to know what the spiritual world is like, a need to know, where did Corey go? Where was I before I was born? Why did my mom have 9 miscarriages? Was it me? What was I doing before I was born? Where will I go when I die? What is this moment of life all about? And so by the time I was 16, 17, by the time I failed out of Kent State University, which is the story for next time in the crucible, by the time I'd failed out of college, I had lived 1,000 lifetimes in my dreams. I had buried the love of my life. I had done so many things that made me almost unrelatable to other people my age, and it reinforced my connection to spirit, because I could pretend to be a regular 19-year-old and go to parties and drink, but man, I was something else altogether. And so I will tell you, when I started to go down the rabbit hole of spiritual learning, I'll save that for the next chapter. But to conclude this episode on the crucible, really, this is about those moments in time when it seems like you're not going to make it. Where maybe you don't want to. Maybe there's something in your heart that is just so weary and so frightened that it wants to give up. Those are the times when we get to look our soul in the eye, purely naked. There's nothing else. If you've known grief, you get stripped naked and there's nothing else. There's no role you can play. There's no facade you can put up. The grief takes you over. Or if you've known depression, it takes you down until you're raw and you look at your soul in that moment and make a choice. And so that's what these moments are for. These crucible moments are there to strip us down to the bottom of the painful well, so that we can see something of ourselves. That's what it's for. We have to look into these fiery, painful, hellish experiences to find the gift, because it's in there like a diamond and it's forged in weight and heaviness and pressure and fire into something that will sustain you all of your life. But you have to be brave and you have to dig. And so that's what we're here for at Naughty Shaman. If you want to dig, you want to start that journey, if you want to start looking into some of these histories that you have, these personal legends of your crucibles, and find the nuggets, the stardust, the diamonds. That's what we do best. That's what we do best because we've lived it. So I encourage you to find us at naughtyshaman.com. And I want to thank you for tuning in to the podcast, because it's just precious to me that so many of you asked about my stories, because sometimes I forget that they might be value in them. So my hope is that you took something of this story and it related somehow into your life, and that somehow it can guide you through whatever it is you have right now. With my love, mwah, 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 this is Natalie Carlisle signing out from Naughty Shaman, where we like to keep the sacred a little bit wild and totally real. If you're hearing this message, you've listened to the entire episode, and for that, we are so grateful. Please reach out to us. Let us know what topics you'd like to see covered in our future episodes. Get in touch in the comments, because we love to hear from you. And you can reach us on social media.